Hi, I'm Deborah Lynn Dadd, and this is Toxic Free Talk Radio, where we talk about how to thrive in a toxic world and live toxic free. It's Tuesday, April 7th, 2015, and it's a beautiful spring day in Clearwater, Florida. Sun is shining. It's actually getting a little warm here. People here are here now on spring break. The beach is full of tourists this week and last week, and obviously, this is a beautiful time in Florida. So today we're going to talk about something that we haven't talked about before on this show, which is toxic exposures to children in schools. And I think that this is a very important subject because, first of all, children have a much more difficult time with toxic exposures than adults. It's bad enough for adults, but children have a greater impact because if you think about a child and an adult standing in the same room, having the same exposure to toxic chemicals, the child's body is smaller. And so the proportion of toxic exposure to body weight is much, much greater for a child. They breathe faster than adults do. And so they're inhaling more of the toxic chemicals they're being exposed to in the air than adults would be inhaling. And so it's just, they're just more sensitive in every way to it. Their bodies, their detox systems are not fully developed. And yet we send children to school every day right into a toxic environment. That you might have a toxic free home, but it's unlikely that your child has a toxic free school unless they've done something about it. My guest today is a economist, a policy analyst, and co-author of a book called The Toxic Schoolhouse, which very thoroughly explains the problem and what people can do about it. This is something that every parent needs to know about and that every school should be paying attention to. I'd like to welcome Dr. Charles Levenstein. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you, Deborah. I'm really glad to be on the show.
Thank you.
I hope what I say can be of help to people.
I'm sure it will be. I've taken a look at your book, and there's just so much information in it. So first, I want you to tell us about yourself, your background, and how you got interested in toxic schools.
Okay. Well, I've been spending years. I was on the faculty of the University of Massachusetts at Lowell in a new department called the Department of Work Environment. And in 2003, I was a professor of work environment, and I retired. At that point, the union, which I had been a member of for many years, the teachers' union, asked me if I would help the union to develop environmental policies for the schools, because they were greatly concerned about exposures to the children and to the teachers and other staff. So I got recruited, and at the time I didn't know much about schools. So a lot of what I did the next years was to learn about what was going on in the schools, what the efforts were to deal with problems in them. I educated myself about it and worked with the Environmental Health and Safety Committee in order to try to improve the situation. The first work that we did was because there were a lot of complaints about indoor air in schools. There were dusts and fumes and odors that the teachers were concerned about, and they were sure that the children were being affected by it. Mm-hmm. And there also has been a great increase in asthma, both amongst children and among adults in the society. So people were afraid that the indoor air pollution that was going on was having some impact on them. So that's really the first issue that I became involved with. Shall I say more about that, or?
Well, no, I just wanted to know briefly your background, just to start with. And then we'll say that you ended up, the end of the story there, well, maybe it's not the end, but somewhere along the way in your story, you were the co-author of a book called The Toxic Schoolhouse.
And yes. I had been the editor of a journal called New Solutions, And in the journal, what we tried to do was to get environmental activists, labor activists, and public health people together talking about issues, not just about schools, but other places. So Madeline Scammell, who's a professor at Boston University, and I did a special issue of New Solutions on health, schools and health. And In the court, we gathered material from a lot of different authors. When we went through it, we realized that this was really, it was not comprehensive. We needed more information. And we talked to the publisher of New Solutions, Baywood Publications, and suggested that we expand this and make a book. And so that's what you've seen, the Toxic Schoolhouse, edited by Madeline and myself, but with authors from all around the country. So we are hoping that this is not the definitive end book of all time. Rather, it is a first, I think, important step in trying to talk about what the exposures are, or some of the exposures are, what people have been trying to do about it, and what the central problems are in the schools. So that's what we were after, really.
And I think that you did a really good job. Obviously, I haven't read the whole entire book, every single word, because I couldn't possibly do that with every guest.
Yeah, sure, but, I understand. Right.
But I've looked at a lot of it, and you bring up some very good points. I just want to start asking you questions about things that you cover in the book. The first question, chapter one, the first thing that you ask is, who's in charge of children's environmental health at school? And I think that's an excellent question. Who is in charge? Who's looking to make sure that the children are not being exposed to toxic chemicals?
Well, you know, this was, because I'm an academic, that's also the most obvious question for me to be asking, because if I want to get information, who do I go to?
Yeah.
The Healthy Schools Network people wrote the chapter on who's in charge, because they also had that question. And the answer to the question is that no one is in charge. And that's very, very disturbing. We had thought that there would be either some state agency or some federal agency that would be concerned about the school environment. And we could not find any single agency that was in charge of it. So if you were concerned about indoor air, that was one kind of problem. If you were concerned about the use of pesticides to control vermin in the schools, that's another issue. If you were concerned about lead in drinking water, it was a separate issue. If you were concerned about asbestos, there were other agencies involved with it. But there was no coordinated overall agency that that was in charge and that was thinking about this. So we were concerned because we had been working on legislation in Massachusetts to improve indoor air. And we would get, it was very receptive. The legislature was very receptive to this, and we went to talk to them. We did a couple of hearings with them. And the only block came when it came up to money. And they would say, well, what is this going to cost, you know, to deal with, to improve the indoor air school environment? And because there had been so much deterioration in the conditions in the schools, it was going to cost a lot of money. And that's when our legislative support sort of backed off, fell away. So there was not only no coordinated effort, but there was no, even in the legislature, there was interest and concern, but resistance because of the financial aspect of it.
Well, that is entirely understandable. But I'm looking at it like I don't have children, so I don't have children in school. But if I did, my question would be, since I know so much about this subject, I would say, well, listen, there's all these chemicals in the schoolroom that can cause things like neurological effects, which affects the brain, which affects the ability to learn. I mean, like exposure to lead reduces IQ, for one thing.
That's
and
right.
So yeah. how are the children supposed to learn in a toxic environment? It's affecting their ability to learn. Before you say anything about this, we need to go to break, but we'll talk about this more when we come back. You're okay. Listening to Toxic Free Talk Radio. I'm Deborah Lynn Dadd. And my guest today is Dr. Charles Levenstein. He is an economist, policy analyst, and author, co-author of The Toxic Schoolhouse. We'll be right back. You're listening to Toxic Free Talk Radio. I'm Deborah Dadd, and my guest today is Dr. Charles Levenstein, economist, policy analyst, and co-author of The Toxic Schoolhouse. So, Dr. Levenstein, before the break, I was bringing up about how can children learn if their schoolroom is filled with toxic chemicals that are affecting their brain function. And so I'm going to let you answer that, but I also wanted to let's just talk about now, what are the toxic chemicals that children are being exposed to at school?
Well, there, one of the major issues is lead in water, and it comes in schools all across the country. Some of it is directly from pipes, but some of it is from the water fountains in which the pipes are welded together with lead-containing material.
Yes.
What can you do about that? Well, you know, one at a time, what you can do is you can run the water first. So if the water's been standing around, then run the tap first for a while, and then drink the water, because that will get rid of some of the lead. But that's a very small part of an answer to this problem. The problem. Let me tell you, when I first got involved with this, I want to ask
you a question just about water, okay?
Yeah.
So looking at it from my viewpoint, if I was a mom and my kid was in school, here's what I'd say. I'd say, look, we can get a very effective water filter that will not only remove lead, but remove all other toxic chemicals from the water for about $300. Let's parents get together and get that water filter so that our kids don't have to drink lead in the water or anything else. Are people not saying this? Are they not, like, are parents not looking for solutions for their children?
Well, part of it is the parents don't know, because there is little monitoring of this problem going on. And so if the parents were informed, I think that they would be concerned and they would be raising these issues through PTAs with the administration of the school. It's also true that the teachers don't know, because that's what we're also trying to educate the teachers about this. So if neither the parents nor the teachers know, then the administrators have a set of priorities that don't include things like lead or PCBs or asbestos, for that matter. All of these problems are well established. There is not really need for new science on lead or on asbestos. There is still need for science on some other materials, but nevertheless, for some of the most basic and ubiquitous problems, the science is out there, and someone should be taking care of it in each of the schools, but also in the school system as a whole. There is no systematic monitoring that goes on of these things. There's no audit that's required. On asbestos, there's supposed to be. Do you want to talk about that at all, or do you,
sure.
or you want
no,
to stay with
ahead.
Lead?
Go ahead.
I
mean, no, go ahead. Well, I,
well
I'm
on,
just,
on the
I'm
asbestos
so...
issue, there is a law, the Asbestos Hazard Emergency Law, which is supposed to be enforced either by EPA, US EPA, or by the state. When we did a survey in Massachusetts to find out what was going on, we found that 90% of the schools were not in compliance with the law. For someone who's worked in the private sector, I was shocked, because you don't have standards that 90% of the businesses don't pay any attention to. So when we looked at it, we found, well, what was it that they were not doing? What were they out of compliance with? And the major thing that they didn't do was they're supposed to inform parents and they're supposed to inform teachers and other staff about the conditions in the school. Once a year, there's supposed to be an audit, and the administration of the school is supposed to inform everyone about that. That's what the key violation was. Well, if that information doesn't go to the parents or to the teachers, then they don't know. They assume that everything is fine, that the kids are okay, and that they themselves are okay. and nothing happens. So the violation of these information providing aspects of laws is really quite fundamental. So
I'm just astounded to hear this. I shouldn't be. I guess I shouldn't be, because I've been doing this work for 30 years, and I've been talking and talking and talking and writing and writing and writing and being on TV and radio and everything, and still the number of people that I think actually know anything about this is a very small percentage. And well, I meet people every day who have never heard of these problems.
I mean, look, I am sympathetic to parents who are working all day long and count on the schools to take care of the kids, and they count on the schools to be safe places.
Yeah.
And they don't really want to think about it too much. And unless some acute problem shows up, then they assume that things are okay. The problem is a lot of these substances don't have an immediate effect. They have long-term effects. So it's even hard to tell whether kids who were exposed, you know, when they were little in school, 10, 20 years later, develop disease or cancer or whatever. It's very hard to keep track of that. It is easier to study the teachers because they are there day in and day out, and they don't move as much, and they have longer-term exposure. So we have been arguing that that there need to be studies of cancer in teachers, of mesothelioma, which is what you get from asbestos. There really needs to be serious attention to that. Some of the parents' advocates are concerned about that because they say, well, what about the kids? Well, it is hard to do the studies of the kids because we would have to track them over long periods of time. But the teachers are there. And when we started to look, for instance, at mesothelioma, the asbestos-related cancer, in the schools in Massachusetts, we discovered that there were 19 teachers right off the bat who had that cancer. And when we pushed the Department of Public Health and the state to look for more, we got it over a period of 10 years. We discovered that there were about 50 staff, teachers, administrators, and custodians who had mesothelioma. Now, that rattled the leadership of the union for sure, because they didn't know that. No one was telling them that. But it meant that their members were getting really seriously ill from this stuff.
I need to interrupt you because we need to go to break, but we'll talk about this more when we come back.
Okay.
You're listening to Toxic Free Talk Radio. I'm Deborah Lynn Dadd. My guest today is Dr. Charles Levenstein. He's the co-author of The Toxic Schoolhouse, a very interesting book about how our children and teachers are being exposed to toxic chemicals. We'll be right back. You're listening to Toxic Free Talk Radio. I'm Deborah Lynn Dadd, and my guest today is Dr. Charles Levenstein, who's the co-author of the book, The Toxic Schoolhouse. And before the break, we were talking about, what were we talking about? We were about to talk about something.
Well, you know, what I was thinking about was the importance of providing information to parents and to teachers and people in the environment. And I was thinking about how important that was, because in the absence of pressure from either the workers there or from the parents of the kids, the administrators have pressures from school boards and from the community for other kinds of results. And they don't think about the impact, for instance, of lead on learning. It's not, you know, it's not at the top of their political agenda. So I
I guess my viewpoint is different, because I've spent all of my adult life studying toxic chemicals in the home and in the world and their health effects and how they affect our bodies and our minds and our ability to think and learn and all of those things. But for somebody who hasn't done that, I can see that something might be more important. But to me, it's like I can't imagine that anything is more important than addressing toxic issues, because toxic chemicals affect our ability to be healthy, our bodies to be healthy. They affect our abilities to think clearly, to be able to remember things, you know, all of these different functions that go into learning or working or earning a living or being happy in life, all can be damaged by toxic chemicals, and all are being damaged by toxic chemicals. That, you know, that if schools are concerned about, you know, test scores, the first thing I would say to them is get the lead out of the school, because lead affects IQ, it affects development, it affects, I mean, there's no safe level for lead. And it just seems like that in the world, and this is why I talk about this so much, but in the world, people aren't aware. I think everybody needs to be aware that these toxic exposures are going on, that they're affecting our health, happiness, and ability, and that they need to be at the top of the list.
Well, you know, I agree with you. I think they should be at the top of the list, and I wondered why they were not at the top of the list. One of the things I did was to look for whether courses on the management of facilities of the buildings were in graduate schools of education, where the administrators and the people who run schools and the people who, you know, who were in charge of all this, do they know anything about this? I could not find one course on the management of the facility. I finally found some things the Association of School Business Officials has some short courses on that, but we really need the principals and the superintendents to know about this, not just the accountants, and there is no course. So part of the reason why we've been forced to educate ourselves is because there's no place where that's happening already. Let me give you an example of a different kind of chemical. PCBs.
Yeah,
PCBs are endocrine disruptors. They're carcinogens and endocrine disruptors. Endocrine disruptor means that they can affect your reproductive system, they can affect growth and the like over a long period of time. Now, if a school was built in the United States between roughly 1950 and 1975, all of those schools used PCBs in the caulking around the windows. Right, or in the fixtures, in lighting fixtures.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, by the end of the late 1970s, there was so much concern about the health effects of PCBs that essentially it was banned in the United States. But it was not banned in the sense of pulling it out of the places where it existed, but it was further production of it and use of it was banned. So, 1975 to 2000, let's say, the caulking around those windows has been disturbed. It's dried up and it's fallen out. It's contaminated the earth around the around the school building. Some of it has gotten into the air filters, you know, into the air system, the air conditioning, and it's a hazard and. We have had some people, there's one of the chapters in the book about a guy from Harvard School of Public Health who has gone out and has done measurements to see how much of this is there and is it a hazard. And in some places it is, and in some places it isn't. But it is the resistance of school officials to looking for it and to finding out about it is enormous. It is true that it would be expensive to deal with. And there's no question. One of the richer school districts in Massachusetts, they found out about it. They did the measurements. They changed all the windows over the summer, and they dealt with the problem. Less affluent school districts don't want to know. It's denial is a big river. You know, they just want to know about it because of the implications for what they're going to have to do. And so we got into trouble at some level because one of our members started to sample to see whether there were PCBs in the caulking, and the school said he was trespassing. You know, it was a big scandal about it. But what are you going to do if the schools themselves are not doing the job and don't want to know? The state departments of health, very concerned about school budgets and taxes, sort of are resistant to knowing too much. And we're worrying because it does affect the teachers, and it does affect the other staff in the place, and it affects the kids. Long-term effects on the kids. We don't, you know, it is deeply concerning, and we had hoped that the control of asbestos was going to be a model for dealing with it. But then it turns out that they don't enforce the asbestos laws. There are laws. I mean, so I initially thought, well, what I was supposed to do as chair of the committee is to propose legislation to improve the situation. And then I realized that we had some laws, but they weren't being enforced, or they were being enforced in a sort of lackadaisical manner because there was no pressure from parents or from the union until we started to raise hell about it. What I'm saying is that parents need to be informed about this, and the PTAs need to be pushing, to get the school systems to make changes.
I think that's the place to start. We need to go to break, but we'll talk more when we come back.
Okay.
You're listening to Toxic Free Talk Radio. I'm Deborah Lynn Dadd, and my guest today is Dr. Charles Levenstein. He is a co-author of the book, The Toxic Schoolhouse, and is working to try to get these toxic chemicals out of our schools and protect our children, which is a very good thing to do. Stay tuned, and we'll be right back. Free Talk Radio, I'm Deborah Lynn Dadd, and my guest today is Dr. Charles Levenstein. He is a co-author of the book, The Toxic Schoolhouse. And there's a couple things I want to say. We're coming to the end of our hour, but I want to get these two things in. The first one is an email that came in this morning. I subscribe to a lot of different feeds of different places, and one of the stories that came in this morning was about fields of toxic pesticides surround schools in Ventura County, California. And it talks about how this is an area that particularly grows strawberries, and we're coming in strawberry season now, and they're talking about all the different pesticides that are used on these strawberries and how the children are being affected, increased asthma, et cetera, as they go to school in near these strawberry fields. They're being sprayed with all these pesticides that are going, I mean, not the children particularly, but, you know, if they're spraying the fields that are right outside the school door, and that, you know, that's going to come into the schoolroom. And certainly pesticides are used in most, if not all, schools, in addition to all these other toxic chemicals.
That's right. I mean, in terms of the spraying of fields, the danger is that it can also get into people's homes because there's a drift of the pesticides in the air. In the schools, we actually were successful in getting legislation to require the schools to develop plans for integrated pest management, which meant the reduction in the use of the most toxic chemicals. And so one of the tasks in doing the book was to find out, well, we know that there are real problems with the asbestos legislation. What about this requirement? So we called it's being enforced by the Department of Agriculture for the state, which is interesting. I hardly knew that there was such a thing in Massachusetts, but there is. So we called them up, and they said, oh, well, it's very successful. 90% or more of the schools have filed the toxic, you know, their integrated pest management plans. And so we said, well, are they actually doing it, or are they just giving you pieces of paper? At which point, we were told there are no inspectors. So the answer is, apparently they're in compliance, but as far as we know, we have no way of knowing if they are actually in compliance, because there's nobody going out and checking. Now, maybe I'm just a nasty urban person, but I think that you have to check when you've got a law. You got to know if it's being enforced or not. And I don't think that parents think a lot about the use of pesticides in the school environment. But in fact, it's inside and outside, because inside there are animals, the kids bring lunch, there are insects that get around. There are cafeterias. And then outside on the grounds, there are small animals and pests and the like. So So it's great to have a plan, and it's great to have to require the schools to have plans, but it is also important that these things be audited. They will not be audited unless the parents put pressure on. It's just that simple.
That's exactly right. And of course, parents could just go and audit the schools themselves. They could just go and ask what's going on and find out why there's toxic chemicals there.
Yeah, I mean, it's not exactly an audit to ask, but it is actually a good idea to ask, because what the parents asking means that the administrators are saying, oh, we better pay attention to this. The other issue in around this thing are the use of cleaning materials.
Right.
And we have been very active in promoting green cleaners. That is, the use of less toxic materials to clean the boards and to clean the classrooms. Problem with that, and I was watching a school system getting an award for being so good about introducing green cleaners, and I went up to congratulate the guy who was in charge of that, who was a facilities director. And I said, that's really wonderful, that you're doing this. Have you been working with the teachers' union at all? And they said, oh, no, the teachers are a real problem. So I said, what do you mean the teachers are a real problem? They said, oh, the teachers bring in their own cleaners because they don't like the green cleaners. And I realized no one had bothered to sit down with the teachers and explain to them what was going on and why they were doing it. And instead, so the teachers are saying, well, that smears, it doesn't work so well. Who knows if that stuff works? And the answer is, you have to educate everybody.
You do have to educate everyone. Right. You do. It can't be, everybody all along the chain here needs to be engaged in this.
Right.
I want to just bring up something else because we've only got about 6 minutes left. And that is, you talked earlier about doing studies. And I just want to share with you and any the listening audience who may be considering what we're talking about here, that I've been studying this subject for more than 30 years. And it started because I got really sick from toxic chemical exposure. Once I figured it out, I said, well, I better find out where the toxic chemicals are if I want to be well. And there's an idea called the precautionary principle. And so I look at studies, I read a lot of scientific studies, but I'm not so reliant on like having a scientific study come and examine my house to see if I'm getting sick. The precautionary principle says if there's evidence of harm, the precautionary thing to do is to not use it.
It seems like a pretty straightforward solution to a problem. Now, if you're still sick after you stopped using it, then it was something else that caused the problem.
Right.
But
that's
if you've
exactly
got large
right.
numbers of kids being affected, I think you are that the precautionary principle should hold.
I think so too. And this is what I
don't want to experiment on the children of the country. That's a crazy way to behave.
That's what's going on. It's like our children are the lab rats for finding out, are there toxic chemicals in the school? And how long do we need to wait? I mean, if you're telling me that there's lead in the drinking water, I can tell you that there's no safe level for lead. There's ample evidence to show the danger of lead. There's no question that lead is toxic and that it disturbs the way children think and feel and learn.
And that is also true of asbestos.
Right.
There is no question that it is a carcinogen. There is a question of exactly how PCBs work, but basically it has been established that it is a carcinogen, a human carcinogen, and it is an endocrine disruptor.
Yes.
Now, what does that mean? I mean, so if you look at studies across the country, you'll see that teachers are at higher risk of breast cancer than one would expect. And so when you ask the question, well, why would that be? Everyone has, there's no answer to that. They sort of don't answer. And so all of a sudden you say, well, if there are PCBs in all the schools or in a lot of the schools, could it be that that's a problem? Or could it be that the pesticides are a problem. You know, what are their environmental exposures?
Could it be the combination of PCBs and pesticides are a problem and all the other toxic things? I just want to throw in also to this discussion is that the way toxic chemicals work, you had mentioned earlier that a lot of things that are in schools are not chemicals that you might see an immediate effect for. And I think that what most people say is, oh, I'm not sick, there's nothing bothering me. But what the piece of information that people don't have is that toxic chemicals get in your body by the various ways that you're exposed to them, and they start to accumulate. And you don't get sick till they accumulate to a certain degree. They have to accumulate. And when you get to that level, then you get really sick. But just because you don't have symptoms doesn't mean that accumulation isn't going on. There are studies which show that this effect is called body burden. And these kids, I'm thinking about these kids sitting in school increasing their body burden of toxic chemicals. And when they get really sick along the line, and studies show that people are having major illnesses that they used to not get till their 50s, 60s, and 70s. They're now getting their 20s and 30s and 40s. And
trouble is it's a lot easier to mobilize people if there is an acute effect.
Right.
So when we had a discussion of PCBs with a group of teachers who were working, and the first thing they ask is, does it give you headaches? And the answer is no, it doesn't give you headaches. Are there any symptoms in the short run, you know, of this? And the answer is no, there are no symptoms. So we're arguing for control of an exposure, and it's going to cost money to do that, to get rid of this stuff, in which there is no immediate impact. It is a long-term effect.
It is a long-term effect that people are not thinking about the long-term effect.
Yeah. So
anyway, we've got less than a minute here, and I don't want to interrupt you from talking
about
something.
Oh, that's okay. Cool.
So I just want to say thank you so much. This is a very, very important subject, and I think that we're just scratching the surface here. But I'm going to talk about it more on the show and see what I can do to start spreading the word.
Okay. Well, and you should tell people that the book is available from Baywood, either as an electronic form or in paperback. And we would love to get people's comments and criticism and suggestions as to the direction in which to go to move forward with this.
And if you go to Toxic, you're welcome.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you. If you go to ToxicFreeTalkRadio.com, I have a link directly to the book.
Great.
So you can
get
it there and listen to the show again if you want. And other shows, I'm Deborah Lynn Gadd. Thanks for listening and be well.